Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you what you are. This film is it just infused with that sensibility. It's very much about this gourmand, played by Benoit Magimel, and the woman who works as his cook and assistant and so on, and played by Juliette Binoche, who had also been one of the other significant food movies, Chocolat, so she knows her food that way. And now these two actors actually had been romantic partners in real life for a while. They actually have a daughter together, and they're no longer romantically linked, but they're still professionally linked here. And you get a sense of that as these two characters they play spend quality time in the kitchen. There's just a rapport between the two of them. And even if you don't know that they were actually, romantic partners in real life, it's just you sense that there's a closeness. But it doesn't mean, as in many conventional movies, oh, they're going to get married.
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Dune Part 2 and The Taste of Things. And we're going to start with Dune Part 2. Mike, this movie was so anticipated. Everybody has just been waiting for this second part to come out. And I guess I want to start off by saying that I also had great hopes for this film, but I was really hoping it was going to be better than the first one, which I, quite frankly, did not like.
Well, I was underwhelmed by the first film as well. And the second film is much better in various ways. And that's rather unusual, isn't it, to have a sequel that actually surpasses the original. And so you and I are talking now not long after the film opened and had a big opening weekend. So certainly a lot of members of the public would agree with us. The first film came out in 2021. So for those people who love it, and there is a cult following for Dune for sure, there has been much anticipated, maybe not as anticipated by me necessarily, but I was kind of pleasantly surprised that in categories you and I will talk about, the second film I think actually really does surpass the first one.
Well, I think there is so much lore that goes with this series, and it was made before, the remake really in 2021. And I always wondered when I watched that first one if it was necessary to have read the books, because they had to spend so much time explaining the world and the characters and who went where and with what. And I rewatched it before I saw the first one, before I saw part two. And it reminded me of everything I didn't like about it. The dialogue was stilted. I thought Timothée Chalamet was, just green. But in the second one, I think he's fantastic. I think he is actually perfect for the role in the second one. It's a complete about face. I don't know if he just got comfortable with the role.
I had a very different take on him, but just by way of a little bit more of backstory here, I freely confess I have not read the Frank Herbert source material, and I refer to it as source material because there's a total of, what, like six novels? And I don't know, I was doing something else in life. I don't know. I haven't read them. And, joking aside on that, I always felt that watching the first film in 2021 and watching this one, it was a liability of sorts. And I always felt that I was like not quite in lockstep with the mythos or mythology percolating here. Like I kind of sort of got it, but I realized there were other things I didn't get. And likewise, I think in the first film, I start to get grounded there, but not totally comfortable with it that way. And actually, in some ways, that's not the first film. As you quickly alluded to, David Lynch had done his disastrous version of it in 1984. I actually have a book about the making of the David Lynch version, and it shows how it was like a totally out of control production. And I don't want to get sidetracked with that, but aside from it, like individual shots that look really great in the Lynch film, the film itself is as I say, a complete train wreck. And you can't go wrong with shots of sandworms. So a sandworm will get your attention, but everything else seemed wrong. So I was not anticipating a reboot of it. And also, I got to freely confess, I'm not the biggest sci-fi fan, and I don't read much sci-fi literature. So personal taste, if you will, but I'm not like the core audience for something like that. I'm keenly aware of that when I sit down to watch, like, who's that? Why'd she do this or that? I'm always like the village idiot when it comes to something like that. But in terms of this film, what works, what doesn't work, I got to, again, I don't mind confessing, I'll boast actually, that I had only like a marginal interest in the story here. And it's relatively easy to follow. So I didn't feel like totally out of it, but I just had at the level of personal interest, there wasn't a whole lot for me there. I was just kind of keeping track with it as it went along. And it does actually get rather involved with various factions and families, if you will. And it does merit that long running time, pushing 3 hours, not quite there. But no, it moves along pretty quickly considering how much material there is in it. So even though I didn't really care that much about the story, I did really admire the spectacle. I thought that as a big budget film, it really, as I say, moved well, and it had great set pieces, and you know, really was quite striking visually. That always held my attention. In terms of the casting in it, it has really a terrific cast. You and I can talk about individual actors there. In terms of Timothée Chalamet, it's such a musical name, so poetic. And in terms of his name, I actually didn't feel he was particularly well cast in the first one. I thought he was quite literally too lightweight for it. And so I wondered in the second one, did he put on weight or something? No, he's still as skinny as ever. And so in a rather sardonic way, I thought, you know, he definitely has movie star features here. So he and Zendaya, actually, as the male-female leads, they have the chemistry. However you want to describe chemistry, the two of them really work together well. They're photogenic, among other things, but they're really gifted on screen. But where I still had reservations about Timothée Chalamet here is this. Admittedly, he's not your conventional action hero. He's not exactly built like Mel Gibson, let's say, okay, much less Arnold Schwarzenegger. So he's not quite in that category. He's kind of scrawny that way. He's a bantamweight in that respect. And you could make the case that it's good unconventional casting. Let's have a hero who's not right out of central casting. And I understand that. But there are places in the film where I was keenly aware of the fact that I wondered if he really truly would be the leader. Would he have that kind of strength? Not just determination, but literal strength. And among other things, because he was so photogenic, I wondered, like, who's the hairdresser out in the desert that takes care of all those curls? You know, I mean, he was always perfectly coiffed, right? And however messy the sandstorm might be, he looked great. That always was a bit distracting for me. But related to that is actually, without spoiling anything in the storyline, he has some really significant fights. I mean, mano a mano in the traditional sense of one macho guy going up against another and the fate of the kingdom's at stake kind of thing. There's one fight where Timothée Chalamet is fighting Austin Butler, who plays like a really bad guy. I mean, really evil and also really well muscled, right? I got to say, like he's ready for any kind of ultimate combat there. He's a gladiator type. And when the two of them are fighting, I guess I am spoiling it in terms of the outcome, but let's just put it this way. I think in realistic terms, Austin Butler would whip his butt, but it doesn't quite play out that way in what we're watching. And I think that's a bit of wish fulfillment at a certain level. So to me, it indicates that it's not entirely successful or working for me in terms of the casting. And also that because I'm not too keenly tied into the storyline, my mind is easily distracted. And I start thinking about hairdos and battlefield plausibility and things like that. But overall, I mean, I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. And you know, I went in with a certain degree of resistance. And so I'm happy that that was, for the most part, overcome. I think we're probably in for many future installments, not just because of the big box office, but the source material has so many books. This could go on as long or longer than any of the superhero series. And in this case, it'd be somewhat more welcome. I think there's stronger core material here than for a lot of the superhero movies. So I'm not entirely dismayed by that. At some point, I may have to break down and like take off a summer and just read the books.
I saw this in Screen X, so I felt like I was in the movie, which was really fun when you got to those action sequences, especially the scene where Timothée Chalamet rides the sandworms across the desert. And can I just say, the sandworms are the story. I mean, from everything I know about Dune, which is not a lot, what you're waiting for is for the sandworms to show up and eat people. I mean, you have to have a few scenes where that happens. And I did think it was actually kind of hilarious that they have this method of actually summoning them with these things that pound on the sand in a rhythmic way that makes the sandworms appear. That this is a way you get rid of some, you know, pesky dead bodies.
You know, we talked briefly about the terrific cast, and the sandworms are the real stars here, and I kept waiting for them. And it reminded me in some ways of Jaws, and that one of the great things about Jaws is that it takes a while to build. Like, you have a sense there's a fin in the water, there's John Williams' ominous music, and it takes a while, not just because Bruce was a mechanical shark that kept breaking down. It wasn't just that. It takes a while to actually get the shark fully on screen. And it takes a while here in this film for the sandworms to make a full appearance, if I can call it that. But the way in which they're summoned, I mean, that's really great filmmaking in the sense of how you get the audience involved, pulled into it, because they respond to vibrations. Like if somebody's walking across the sand or there's a pounding sound. So they have these metal devices implanted in the sand. And of course, you know, there's a kind of rhythmic pounding with them that some sort of summons them. And they do want to summon them on occasion, because the absolute highlight visually is when Timothée Chalamet or others eventually will actually ride. I mean, it's like a chariot race almost, but where you're riding the sandworm. That was really terrific filmmaking. I mean, you can't go wrong with that. What I wanted a little bit more of, and this sounds like a sort of sadistic, bloodthirsty request, but when the sandworm's doing their best to, kill humanity, I don't know, call it the sort of like the King Kong quotient. You know what I mean? Like, I wanted a little bit more of that, a little more consumption of humans. And because there are a lot of places in the film where the sandworms are like just under the surface, right? Or they're just starting to break through. I wanted more of the big reveal. Like, this is a huge sandworm and it's going to eat not just you, but your whole village.
I felt the same way. I kept hoping for more sandworm carnage. And then I felt a little ashamed of myself.
I know. And here we're confessing to our audience. So what kind of people are these? The movie is rated PG-13. I'll let you know. If it gave us too much more, it might go into our territory. So it's safely PG-13. You can take the kids.
But you're right. There is kind of that Jaws. You know, if you're going to have a monster, you know, you have to reveal the monster from time to time. Everybody's on tenterhooks waiting for the next chomp. All right, so there's something I wanted to mention in terms of Timothée Chalamet being kind of like a slight character that, I mean, is this really the one, you know, if you borrow something from The Matrix? So I had read it took so long to make this movie that they became sort of discouraged by the fact that people like George Lucas pillaged so much of the ideas for Star Wars, which hadn't occurred to me until they said that, and then I could totally see it, including, you know, Mark Hamill as the character, this kind of callow young man who suddenly finds out he has this huge role in the universe and that whole hero's quest. What do you think of that?
Well, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, George Lucas had done his homework, mythologically speaking. Lucas was omnivorous that way. Think about the influence of the old 1930s serials like Flash Gordon, and, you know, not just for source material, but for source style, all the wipe shots that were used in the films that he would use, you know, a kind of old-fashioned technique to use in Star Wars coming out in 1977, but that Lucas picked up on that. He also, you know, was thinking about Joseph Campbell. He was thinking about Dune. I mean, you know, because Dune was certainly a, you know, anyone in the sci-fi world would have known that really well as a novel, as potential material. So Lucas was, should we call him shameless or just shrewd, that he was able to play off of a lot of it. And typically in hero narratives, you have a certain narrative arc that you kind of expect. So that in this film, when you have the Timothée Chalamet character actually ordained as what the one tribe calls the Messiah, you can really see how there's a certain heroic figure that's going to work through the narrative. And if you look at, I'm sounding like Carl Jung here in terms of a universal subconscious or something, but when you think about the ways in which mythologies around the world tap into the same essential storyline, the names of the gods are different, some of their attributes are a bit different, but the essential narrative and its purpose, psychologically speaking, is much the same. And I think this film, in the same way as with Lucas, taps into things like that. So even though I didn't always understand the surface particulars in terms of the actual story, not having read the book, dummy I am, but the fact that I could follow it in terms of a kind of predictable narrative, but in an agreeable sense. In other words, there's a ritualistic quality to what this figure represents and how various peoples respond to him. And I could automatically tap into that. And that's to the credit of the film, is that it knows that and occasionally wears it on the sleeve. I mean, to actually call somebody a messiah is sort of like, you know, tipping the hand a bit that this is the messiah. And if you have to have a messiah, he's a pretty good choice, actually. You know, who do I want to be saved by? Yeah, he can save me. I'll go with that.
Okay, so one of the things that is a pleasure about watching this movie, and a small but significant pleasure in the part one, is the cast of thousands in the background where you're like, oh, I love that actor. I love Florence Pugh. I love Stellan Skarsgård. I love Christopher Walken. What did you think about what kind of boiled down to cameos in a way?
And Javier Bardem, right?
And Javier Bardem, yes.
Some of them are more than cameos, and yet some of them are, you're right. It can be very distracting when you have a really famous actor's face and the person essentially is just in a few scenes. It can kind of snap you out of the story. I think the film borderline flirts with that. I think occasionally it is, like, because you have a mob of people in the desert and then you see this famous face in the middle of, how'd she get there? That can be a bit of an issue. I think it'll be less of an issue as the film series goes on. In other words, assuming some of these figures pop up again, at least the ones who weren't bumped off, assuming some of them pop up again, there'll be more familiarity. And I think, and I'm being generous in this interpretation, but some of the faces seen fleetingly here presumably will have more screen time ahead of us. And so ultimately that may not be a bad thing, because almost like with the superhero movies, when you have a big enough cast and you know the faces, sometimes you get a little more screen time here, sometimes there, and the audience kind of settles in. It's sort of like the family reunion. Oh, there's so-and-so again. I only saw her for 5 minutes last time, but now we have her for 20 minutes, you know, so I'm not too worried on that score.
Speaking of score, the score is amazing. But I also wanted to mention that the cinematography is incredible. This has to be a technical tour de force in so many ways. Do you think it's going to be lost by the end of the year in terms of award nominations? How much staying power do you think this movie's going to have?
This doesn't speak well to the public memory, but what typically happens in Hollywood is you will have some major film releases in the spring, and they're being praised in the way we're praising this in different categories. And yet by the fall, they almost seem like ancient history. I plead guilty on this as much as anyone. I have to remind myself, oh yeah, I saw that last spring. That was pretty good, wasn't it? But because we get that fall onslaught of Oscar bait movies, and it's easy to somehow push aside good films from earlier in the year. It's one reason why typically Hollywood, in terms of looking for Academy Award recognition, will have things not front-loaded, but back-loaded in the calendar year. And so again, I think you make a good point. Now this film, I'm assuming it'll get nominations in top categories, but you know what? For sure, it will get all the technical nominations. So there's no doubt about that. I mean, if you're going to have a category like five entries for best cinematography or best set design, blah, 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 well, how can you not have this included in the list? And also, it seems destined to be one of the top box office draws of the year. And that carries some weight in Hollywood in terms of nominations in technical categories. I don't know if it'll necessarily get nominations in acting categories, because, you know, the actors are very much part of that overall, not just acting ensemble, but just the overall environmental setting, if you will. So I don't know if it'll get nominated that way. For sure, the director should get a nomination, but, you know, you can't count on anything in that respect. There are films that get nominated for Best Picture, but the director's not nominated. Like, did this movie make itself? And so I get kind of cynical on that score.
So obviously they've teed up Dune 3. What do you think they have to do in Dune 3 to kind of go past what they did here? I'm going for more people being eaten by sandworms, but what's your take, Mike?
Well, I'm obviously not qualified to respond in the sense of I don't know the source material well enough as to where it goes next. In terms of where the film goes next, I think the sandworms will have a really prominent role the next time out, because if the producers are watching this show, and I hope they are, you know, I want them to make note of this, that we want that delivered to us there. And I think that'll happen. Also, that one of the intangibles for someone who doesn't really know the material is just that there are several what I'll call tribal groups. I mean, this is a planet not only with many grains of sand on it, but also many different peoples and kind of jousting, if you will, between them. So as they're fighting for the future of the planet, and I don't know why, I just want to get off that planet, but if you're fighting for its future, I can understand various scripted permutations as to different alliances and who's going to win. Because after all, this is a film that involves an aristocracy and a line of succession. And that's something that you could easily see play out in future installments. Like, well, okay, who's the Messiah? Who's in charge now? But now you have some other guy coming along saying, well, wait a minute, I should be next in line to the throne. It's even more contentious than the British royal family. It's really, really something.
And that's saying something. Okay, unless you have a final word on that, Mike, we'll move on to the taste of things.
Okay, let's move on.
Let's move on. All right, so the main thing to mention about this movie is the director, An Hung Tran. And I looked up what the director had done previously and realized that one of the movies was A Scent of Green Papaya and another movie called Norwegian Snow. And when I was watching them, I thought, oh, you know, if you want to go see The Taste of Things, go see those two movies first. You'll totally be ready for what you're going to get here, which is a very detailed tableau of sensuous imagery.
That's a great way to start, I think, because The Scent of Green Papaya is a sensual film. It came out in 1993. The director's own background, born in Vietnam, but then at the age of, I think, 12, moves to France. And even that film, Scent of Green Papaya, it's set in Vietnam, but it was shot in France. So this is a director who not only knows French culture, but lives it, if you will, and then has incorporated into films in various ways. But in that film that you and I are talking about now, from very early in the career, food plays a big part there, actually. There are scenes where you're really drawn to that. And this director has done his gastronomic homework. The film itself, Taste of Things, the story is set in the 1880s, but in terms of source material for the film, it's loosely based on a novel from the 1920s, which I haven't read. I guess today's episode is revealing all the novels I have not read, but I have not read that one. But that novel, in turn, is based very closely, the central gourmand character, and it's based very closely on an actual 18th century food writer and just food expert, Brillat Savarin, who wrote a book. And I've got to give you the title of this book because it indicates just how deep you can get in your knowledge. This goes even deeper than anything in Dune in terms of like really delving into a subject. So this is an 18th century book about food. And the title of the book is The Physiology of Taste, or Meditations on Transcendental Gastronomy. And in that source text from the 18th century, there's a very famous sentence, which I actually had seen before in other writing about food, but the sentence is this: "Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you what you are." This film is just infused with that sensibility. It's very much about this gourmand played by Benoit Magimel and the woman who works as his cook and assistant and so on, and played by Juliette Binoche, who had also been one of the other significant food movies, Chocolat, so she knows her food that way. And now these two actors actually had been romantic partners in real life for a while. They actually have a daughter together, and they're no longer romantically linked, but they're still professionally linked here. And you get a sense of that as these two characters they play spend quality time in the kitchen. There's just a rapport between the two of them. And even if you don't know that they were actually, you know, romantic partners in real life, it's just you sense that there's a closeness. But it doesn't mean, as in many conventional movies, oh, they're going to get married. He would like to marry her, but she's independent-minded in various ways. And so the movie focuses partly on that kind of very discreet, very subtle courtship of sorts over many years between the two of them. But the real focus, of course, is the food itself. And when they were making the movie, the director had a funny comment. He said, when we were making the movie and all these scenes, he said, first of all, he would not allow any professional food stylists on the set. They were banished. This was going to be food in which they actually would use vegetables that I call ugly vegetables, things you won't find at Whole Foods. These are misshapen, whatever, what you'd be growing in the yard, actually using them in the kitchen. They look real because they are right out of the garden, a little bit of dirt still on them. And as you prep them there, he wanted the meals made essentially in real time, in a real way, as they would have been cooked in the 1880s. So there's that verisimilitude that's so palpable within the film. But anyway, the director said when they were shooting those scenes, he would shout, "Cut," but the actors would go right on eating. they wouldn't stop there. And that's really, I think, the great virtue of this film. It's immediately on the all-time, like what I call short list of great food movies. I mean, it really, really is so convincing. And you want to rush out and get a meal right after seeing it. It's a really lovely film. And not just because of all the great food in it, but the fact that the characters are so well portrayed. I mean, you really feel like you know these people. It's just beautifully crafted. I think it's a lovely film.
I agree. I would say to our audience, don't go see this movie hungry or without any snacks, watching all this food be prepared. And I love HGTV, Food Network. I love watching people cook things. So, I mean, I was ready for this movie. And I loved the way they showed, like you said, the vegetable being dug up out of the yard, and then they would bring it in and turn it into something. You know, you'd see him pick out a wine, and you were very aware that the grapes for that wine had probably been grown in the yard. Just the whole farm-to-table idea, really well rendered. And the book itself, I did find a Kindle version from Amazon, and it's in French, and even the French words are sumptuous. You just want to savor every bit of what they're detailing. You mentioned chocolat, and I did think, before I tied it into this director and their tendency to focus on details and really let you experience things. I don't know. I felt like she kind of used her performance from Chocolat. There were certain simpering looks that I thought were very similar to her performance in that. But you know what it reminded me most of, Mike, was Babette's Feast. And also a little bit of Remains of the Day. What do you think?
Well, you know, you and I have talked about food movies before for some reason. We've had an interest in them. And my short list includes films I've used in courses I teach. I use Tampopo, the Japanese film, and a course I teach on Asian cinema. Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, is a film I use in that same course.
Babette's Feast. The intro to that is one of the best food scenes of all time.
Babette's Feast I use in my Scandinavian film course. Big Night's a film that, you know, we should get Americans have food too, so we should get that in there. Italian Americans have food at least. And I'm not a big fan of Chocolat as a film, I got to confess. I don't think it's a particularly strong film, but it does have some great food imagery. And Juliette Binoche is, you know, really a treasure as an actor, so I'll give it that point or those points. But I think I like her more in this film because the film itself, I think, is more fully realized. I think it's more subtle, it's more complex. I think Chocolat's kind of simplistic in various ways. I think this film has a lot more nuance to it. And there's so many things I like about this film that are there, but not like overstressed. I'll give an example. Okay, so the two of them work together closely in the kitchen. His character, he really is like a nationally famous gourmand. Like he writes books and he's an expert in this and that. People want his opinion on things. She's basically his assistant, but she's learned everything, of course, working alongside him. But the fact that he has a network of friends, these are like professional colleagues that he regularly has, I'll be generous and say, like long lunches with. I don't know how they do anything else during during the day, but like he and a few of the guys get together for a long lunch and she's there helping to serve and so on. But these friends of his, they're like, one would be like a doctor, a lawyer, like all clearly professionals, right? Middle-aged or upper middle-aged, distinguished looking, but they never seem to work. I mean, I was joking with an audience that I watched it with that I thought, well, you know, this must be like one of those French vacations where everybody takes off in August or something. Everyone's just sitting around. I thought, well, don't you have like an appointment or something? It's like, you started at noon. It's now 2 p.m. Don't you have anything else to do? I guess they wouldn't have had Zoom meetings in the 1880s, but something to do at that point. But I like that quality of the film because when the guys sit around the table, and it is the guys, when they sit around the table, it has the leisurely pace of a well-planned meal. And sometimes, and this is a point that the film makes very astutely, that there's another character in the film, an aristocratic character, who wants to impress them by serving a really fancy lunch and with everything on the menu. And actually, our protagonist, he kind of looks askance at that, like, well, there's like no discernment, no plan, no logic to this. It's like he's trying to impress us, like in a nouveau riche way with everything on the menu. He said, no, let's just do pot au feu, which was the original title of the film even. Let's just do a basic French dish and do it well. And he makes the point that sometimes simplicity is the best virtue in terms of cuisine. Don't get too fussy or too elaborate. Have the integrity of those ugly vegetables, have a really well-planned preparation for them, and don't put too many things on the menu and have them in the right order. And that is really satisfying in the meal. And so what I'm getting at there is, like, as you're watching this, you really are getting an education, not only in culinary practice of the 1880s, which might not be high on everybody's agenda, but not just that, but in effect, you know, what is the good life? What is the good meal? Because they're synonymous, right? And how to really, like, perfect your food. And honestly, it's the path to better living. I mean, it's not kind of trite to say it so bluntly, but it is really. These people are living a good life. And yet, you know, he wants it to be even better by marrying her. And again, that's something I won't spoil at all in terms of how it plays out. But the fact that there is a kind of amorous back and forth on that, but it's handled so gently in the film. You never feel like it's going into like a trite melodrama because you can work with people for years and be fond of them. Well, what if one of them is a bit more fond than the other or wants to like formalize it? Like, well, let's get married. And you know, so, no, we work well in the kitchen. We don't have to be married otherwise. And again, there's a degree of suspense in the film, not edge of your seat defense. You know, you're not going to have a sandworm pop out of the French garden. But Marie, don't you agree there is an element of suspense here? So well, how's this going to play out?
Yes. And at the end of the day, it's all about the food, which is, it's kind of nice that it stays true to that idea that sort of staying in the moment and appreciating the small moments that make life. All right. So my last point I want to make, want to get your opinion. This was the French offering for best foreign film, but did not make the short list. Was it robbed?
I've had discussions about this with friends, friendly arguments, and some of my friends said, yeah, it was robbed. And it certainly merited that. But by the same token, Marie, as you know, within the past year, there have been some really strong international films. You have the long list of films. This is what the French were, you know, putting forward. You have the long list, and then you get that short list, which actually, you know, then it gets announced as a winner on Oscar night. So pragmatically speaking, you had certainly more than five films that would have merited being on the short list. And so, you know, realistically speaking, it's a shame that it didn't make the list there. But when you look at the films that did make the list, I can't complain about them either. So, you know, them's the breaks that way. But ultimately, this is a discussion we're having in the moment. Long term, project ahead 5 or 10 years, and we'll still be thinking about this film and whether it got an Oscar or not. Not that it doesn't matter, but you know what I'm saying? You can still sit down and watch this film, enjoy it, and then go off to a French restaurant.
Absolutely. That's the best way to end seeing this movie. So that does bring us to the end of this episode, but don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.